thanks the organizers for a wonderful conference. It's a pleasure to be here. If you need me to speak up, wave at me. I tend to lower. Okay. I will try. All right, so, and thanks all for hanging around still until so late, especially after the adventure at the hotel last night. I do appreciate you being here. Okay, so just to reiterate on one key point, there's lots of evidence pointing to this consistent picture of there being six times more invisible matter in our universe than baryons. All this evidence comes from gravitational interactions. There are lots of negatives about dark matter, and we have a lot of theoretical ideas for what it might be. And this quest to understand the physical nature of dark matter, in part, boils down to understanding how this thing interacts with the standard model particles, and that's what I'm going to focus on in this talk. So the current status of the field of this quest is depicted in this plot we've seen about, I don't know, 30 times in this conference. And so the key point, of course, is that dark matter, whatever it is, has proven to be maybe trickier to probe than we had originally hoped. And so we really can't afford to leave any stone unturned, and we should turn to all the observables and experiments that we can to try to get at the dark matter interactions and push these exclusions, or push that more on this parameter space downwards, but also towards the lower masses to the left, which is also what I'm going to focus on, talking about cosmological probes of dark matter interactions. So as a cosmologist, one of our favorite tools to ask questions about new physics in general, and also in particular about dark matter, is this cosmic microwave background radiation. And so I know that Jano gave a quick overview of the CMB physics yesterday, but it's important for what I'm going to be talking about. So I just want to bear with me as I try to bring everyone on the same page really quickly. So you can think of the CMB as the earliest snapshot of our universe, when the universe was was a linear system in the simple state of acoustic oscillations. And so the fluctuations, the anisotropies that we see in the CMB sky, sort of map onto the density fluctuations in this early universe. And a good analog might be to think about a mass suspended off an elastic spring in a gravitational field of the Earth, where the elasticity of the spring would be this pressure of the hot plasma. That's the restoring force that pushes the baryons out of the potential wells formed by dark matter. And so, of course, the way we usually quantify the properties of these CMB maps in temperature and in polarization is by measuring the amount of power in fluctuations of these anisotropies on a given angular scale in the sky L, where the angular scale decreases in this direction. And so these are the famous CMB temperature power spectra. And so this is our basic observable when we talk about constraining physics with the CMB. And of course, it's sensitive not only to the total amount of matter in the universe. So if I were to erase all of dark matter, it would look drastically different. But it's also sensitive, as we know, to the a fraction of matter that is allowed to interact with photons. So if I were to substitute all of dark matter with baryons, it wouldn't work again. But as we've also heard, in Celine's talk yesterday, the power spectra of the CMB encode potentially signatures of dark matter interactions with baryons as well, and self-interactions and decays and annihilation and so on. Then I'm going to focus on interactions between dark matter and baryons. So if we modify the standard cosmological picture and introduce some amount of coupling between dark matter and, say, protons, then we automatically introduce a drag force that now acts on the baryon fluid. So you can, at a conceptual level, again, you can think of immersing this system of the oscillating mass into a bucket of water. And so this friction from the water basically damps out the oscillations. And the effect on the power spectra is damping of the small scale power, both in temperature and in polarization, which is shown here exaggerated, is an exaggerated effect. And the exact shape of the change in the power spectra that we expect to see will depend on the exact nature of this interaction. Which brings me to the point of now discussing what I mean by the nature of interaction and what space of theoretical possibilities do we focus on in this work. So we made the choice that instead of examining individual complete high energy theories of dark matter, we restrain ourselves to working within the non-relativistic effective theory formalism, first derived by Fitzpatrick, Anand, Haxton, and others for the purposes of describing all possible signals that you might expect to see in direct attraction experiments. So Chris briefly mentioned having worked in the same framework. So just very briefly, what these folks did, they came up with a full list of Galilean Hermitian invariants, such as the momentum that are involved in this scattering process in direct attraction experiments, the momentum transfer, the sweep perpendicular quantity that relates to the relative velocity between dark matter and nuclei, and again, the momentum transfer, and then the spins of dark matter and nucleons. And then they simply wrote down all the operators that can be derived from these quantities and came up with a list of about 15 operators that describe elastic scattering, threat or scalar, or vector mediators between nucleons and dark matter particles. And in doing so, they went took into account interactions that may have non-trivial velocity and momentum dependence in their cross-section. So in that sense, they went beyond the considering the standard to spin-dependent contact interactions that we talk about most often when we talk about exclusions from direct attraction experiments. And so for the rest of the talk, when I say model or theory, what I will refer to is a choice of one of these operators, where each one of these operators, each one of these models comes with two free parameters, the coupling coefficient associated with it, one for scattering with neutrons and one for scattering with protons. And then there's, of course, the dark matter particle mass as another unknown parameter. Just flashing quickly the list of these operators, but if you're interested in more details about this formalism, I will point you to look at those references. But the key point that I want to get across here is that you should think about this effective theory formalism that we use as a way to really parametrize all possible interactions that we can see at low energies through these couple of coefficients for scattering with protons and neutrons. And then, these would be our observables that we look to constrain with the cosmological and CMB data. And so once we do so, then if you're interested in any particular high energy theory, you can use the mapping between that theory and these coefficients in order to constrain its parameters. But this is the sense in which I mean assuming the model independent approach in trying to constrain interactions between dark matter and baryons. So this is the work in progress I'm doing with Kimberly Body from the University of Hawaii. And so what we've done is we've now embedded this formalism in a cosmological context. So in direct attraction, we're used to thinking about the differential cross-section as a function of the momentum transfer. But in cosmological context, we usually talk about the total momentum transfer cross-section. So we integrate over the momentum. The momenta, and then we end up with a cross-section that can generically be a function of the relative velocity between dark matter and protons. And so the next step is like in direct attraction experiments, we have to integrate over the velocity distribution at a given redshift and come up with an expression for the rate of momentum exchange r as a function of redshift, which is then a function of these three parameters of the model, which are the dark matter particle mass and then the coupling to neutrons and protons. Then we can modify the Boltzmann equations to include interaction between baryon and dark matter fluids. And compute the effect of this interaction on cosmological perturbations projected onto the sky to get the predictions for what the CLs, what the power spectra in the CMB should look like. And that gives us a tool to then go and analyze CMB data to draw constraints on these different different interaction types.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
So when people are breaking down this effective theory, they thought of some very weak interactions, the sort of analog of weak interactions between the dark matter and the neutrons and protons, right? So that's why they were using contact operators and so on. If you're going to use it for CMB on a later date, after redshifts relevant for the CMB, so if this were a weak scale interaction, it's probably going to have a negligible effect. So
so you will see what kinds of cross sections we're able to define the same again that the lens layer.
Right, so what I'm trying to say that probably there has to be some sort of model on the scale, a nuclear scale in some sense.
Yeah, so we do assume contact interaction, for instance. Okay, just to be a little bit more formal, so again, I said, If you
introduce these interactions, you introduce an extra drag force between baryons, between baryon photon fluid and dark matter. And so I'm just, for the people who do think about the CMB a lot, these are the standard Boltzmann equations that that track the evolution of the density perturbations in dark matter and in baryons. And then thetas are just the velocity divergences. So this system of equations is modified by the addition of these momentum transfer terms between the two fluids. And on the bottom here, I've put down the form of this momentum transfer rate for not for the models that we're looking at, but for simpler models where the cross-section is taken to be just some constant times some power of the relative velocity. But it's the form is simpler, but it gets the point across where this momentum transfer, which is the only thing that enters the Boltzmann equations, really depends on this cross section, which relates to the coefficients that go with the operator at hand, and then it also depends on the mass of the dark matter particle, temperatures of baryons, and dark matter at a given redshift. And then also it depends on the power of velocity dependence and in the cross section.
So before you move on, so is that the fraction of helium?
Yes.
So why is that in this term? Is that somehow significant or is that just the parameters?
It's just, yeah. All right. Now I would like to take just a minute to tell you what kind of data we have at hand. Again, for those of you who don't think about the CMB all the time. So the best precision data that we've gotten so far until recently has been from these full sky surveys from satellites like Planck and WMAP before it, and they've done a fantastic job mapping out CLs at lowish multiple moments. But as you've seen, these kinds of effects of dark matter baryon interactions tend to be most prominent in the at higher Ls, at smaller scales. And so the field is being pushed forward these days in terms of mapping out small scales in temperature and especially in polarization by several ground-based experiments that look at small patches of the sky and integrate deep. And such experiments are the two biggest ones in the field are the South Pole Telescope, the SPT, and also the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, or ACT. And so I've recently joined the ACT-Pole collaboration, one of the reasons being to bring this analysis, to do this exercise of constraining dark matter interactions with ACT-Pole data. So today I don't have constraints from the data. We're analyzing Planck data at the moment, but I do have projections, some preliminary projections to show you, just so you can see what order of magnitude of these cross sections do we expect to get from Planck alone. So here on the left-hand side, this is a plot just for the spin and velocity independent scattering. So this is a standard spin independent scattering. The chains are not completely converged here. That's why the lines are jaggedy. But again, within an order of magnitude, this is the kind of exclusion plot that that you can directly compare with direct attraction results. And if we marginalize over the dark matter mass, which is another fitting parameter, we get something at one sigma on the order of 10 to minus 31 centimeters squared. And so what I want you to take from this plot is that we're pushing into new parameter space, looking at light dark matter. We're able to go down to masses of an order of an MeV. So cosmological probes typically, as you see from these numbers here, in the regime where direct attraction nuclear recalls are able to make a statement, it's always way stronger than what cosmology can do. We will never get to those levels of cross-sections, but we can go to lower masses. And then also, one important note, I think, is that there's something to be said about complementarity between cosmological probes and all other ground-based experiments, and that's that we can make statements that are about the very same physics we probe with these experiments, but at extremely high ratchets, and also because of that, they're independent of the local astrophysical dark matter properties as well. So the next step is we're right now analyzing Planck data. We want to constrain each one of these different non-relativistic effective operators and produce plots like what I've showed you from Planck data for each one of those. And then we're getting ready to co-analyze Planck and small-scale ACPOL data, which will add sensitivity to this kind of power suppression effects at high multiples. And for the future, we might start to consider including also analysis of large-scale structure probes, such as, for example, Lyman Alpha, in order to probe this kind of suppression of power in the matter power spectrum directly. And there are other ideas, such as to look at, include in this formalism scattering of electrons, to consider spectral distortions as well, and so on. So just to summarize, when we compare with direct attraction experiments, I don't really want you to read off exactly the numbers on this axis, but schematically, this is what we're doing with cosmology. So far, analysis of the CMB and large-scale structure data have gone down to about a GeV. With this analysis that we're doing now on Planck and ACPOL, we'll be able to push down to masses down to an MeV and push these curves lower down, especially given the handle on this small-scale polarization data from ACT. And one of the highlights is that, of course, as Chris has mentioned earlier today, given the order of magnitude of the cross-sections we're able to probe with cosmological probes, this might actually be a range of the parameter space that's not accessible to direct attraction experiments, in the sense that a lot of these particles at those cross-sections might get stopped in the Earth's crust before they make it all the way to the detector. And then, of course, as Tony pointed out briefly yesterday, direct attraction relies on knowing what the local astrophysical properties of dark matter particles are. And by local, I mean really local at the scale of the solar system. And those are not direct observables. We infer them from stellar motions and from and body simulations and so on. Those are big caveats for what we from the conclusions we draw from direct attraction experiments. And then, more speculatively, of course, if we were to, for example, make a tentative detection with generation two experiments at low-ish masses, maybe cosmological probes will be able to see an anomaly as well. So, in that sense, they may be a complementary probe of the same physics of dark matter interactions. Okay, so instead of a conclusion, I just want to give you a sense. I realize again that this audience is perhaps not as aware about what are these happy news in the CMB community as of last year. So where the CMB field is going in general, in terms of what data we will have, is that So far, we had several small collaborations. I mentioned SBT Act, there's Polar Bear, Bicep, and so on. They all did their own thing individually, but as of about, I think, a year and a half ago or something like that, the whole CND community has come together to start planning the stage four experiment. And this this project has been endorsed last year by the biggest funding agencies in the US, the NSF and DOE. So that is sort of the future of the field. And in the meantime, the ACPOL and Polar Bear collaborations have gotten $45 million from the Simons Foundation to make basically a big step in the direction towards the stage four experiment. And that will be, that's a 5-year program. So in the early 2020s, we should be on the sky taking awesome new data that will address not only the physics of dark matter, but also will be aiming at neutrino masses and other new interesting physics beyond the beyond what we know now. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to say that they're impressed by the size of the cross section that you can grow. I not expected for that. Great, but returning to my previous comments, so this classification by Hansen et al. And Fitzpatrick and so on, it's more for the how to make an account of nuclear effects within the nucleus, mm-hmm. right? So at your level, you'd be perfectly fine, but just because you don't have a nuclei, you just have protons, yes. right? So you just can parameterize everything in terms of the, like, vector operator on the proton, spin operator on the proton. This by itself would be probably a smaller set because you don't have the complicated nuclear matrix elements to care about, right? So you can shrink the number of operators. That's what I'm trying to
say. Follow up on that, does the scattering with helium matter that much?
So it's less abundant, but you have it's secure in scattering, and then you get an enhancement.
Right.
So it does matter. It ends up mattering, I think.
Yeah, I mean, but sort of at like a comparable level to protons. What I'm interested in, follow up maximum point, is if there's some operators that really, really care about that you have helium as a nucleus as opposed to just an ordinary proton, then it would make sense to use the EFT.
I mean, if it couple, because you mentioned that, I mean, there's couplings between like the proton and dark matter or neutron dark matter. Okay, so if these two couplings are, say that for some reason you have like a very strong coupling from neutron dark matter and not from proton dark matter, then the protons are out of the game, right? So it's going to be only the helium that's going to contribute to that. Okay. So in that case, I think it would be good matter, right?
Well, that's an example. Ultimately, it might be interesting to see like. How your results look like if you just pretend helium doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Because then you can pinpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. We're looking at that.
So can you go back a slide, maybe? So, like Maxime, I'm also very impressed by the...
This is not... So don't look at the numbers here. I should have covered them up. This is for a different model. This is not helium.
The minus 31, right?
Nope. Yeah, this is...
Okay, I'm still impressed.
Yeah. There's a word preliminary there.
What I'm doing is the opposite of complaining.
Yeah. It's just accepting what people talk about.
It's better than what we had expected. Yeah. What we tried to compare with previous work,
yeah.
sort of taking the limits that they've. We've done a few things better than what's been done before.
Yeah, that's great. So I just have a question,
but,
following my compliment. this really is velocity independent?
Yes.
Okay. So that's interesting because, if you have velocity dependent, you have something that goes from 1 over velocity, then you can see an advantage of doing the cosmology treatment. Because you have some periods in the universe where the velocity is very low, that would be very sensitive to that. But if it's just velocity independent, it's wonderful if it's this strong.
Yeah, for the moment, we're looking only at positive powers of velocity.
Okay.
There are complications if you couple with wave times,
yeah.
Like the relative velocity, the bulk relative velocity in dark matter and baryons, and that's something we're going to have to think about more carefully how we
do this. Last question, why stop at 1 MV?
We don't want it to be relativistic for the directions we're integrating over, basically, because we're working in the context of the non-relativistic effective theory. That in principle, there's no reason.
So we're working on something similar. Yeah. Jenny mentioned it. This is against my own competitive interest, but I think you should go ahead and lower our masses just to show what you get.
Okay.
But that actually gets into our territory, which makes it more difficult for us, but you should do it.
I know you're looking at
elections. We had a great conversation about it, but it's on our to-do. It's not an immediate future kind of thing, but it's on our to-do for reasons, and it's why we don't.
It just seems that one happens only to the two neutrons. Do you have an estimate like how this limit moves?
I don't know off the top of my head. We're looking into this. We have a way to, we included set in of helium, but we have a way to turn it off. So we will definitely do this.
So if you've had a brief conversation about electron scattering, would you think it makes more sense to think about ionizing hydrogen by scattering, or just look at the ionized fraction left over?
You mean what do I expect to be more important? I don't know. I'm not sure. Let's talk about it.
What redshift is the scattering? Is there like a window in which it's?
So for the decoupling happens at very early times. So like redshift between 10^4 and 10^7, something like that. So most of the effect happens is imprinted at very early times.
Very early times. So helium.
Actually have technically a discussion, but I don't know if we're here or not.
Past the
past discussion.
Friday night.